following evening, Lord Warburton went to see his friends at their hotel, but was told they had gone to the opera. He drove to the opera with the idea of paying them a visit in their box after the easy Italian fashion. On gaining his admittance during a recess, he scanned two or three tiers of boxes and perceived in the largest a lady whom he easily recognized. Miss Archer was seated facing the stage, and beside her was Mr. Gilbert Osmond. They appeared to have the place to themselves, and Warburton supposed their companions were enjoying refreshments. As he made his way up the stairs, he met Ralph Touchett slowly descending.
"I was coming down to meet you," was Ralph's greeting. "I feel lonely and want company." "You've some that's very good, which you've yet deserted. Do you mean my cousin? Oh, she has a visitor and doesn't want me. Then Miss Stackpole and Bantling have gone out to a cafe to eat an ice. I didn't think they wanted me either. The opera's very bad, and I feel very low." "You had better go home," Lord Warburton said without affectation. "And leave my young lady in this sad place? Oh, no, I must watch over her. If she doesn't want you, she won't want me. No, you're different. Go to the box while I walk about."
Lord Warburton went to the box, where Isabel's welcome was as to an honorable old friend. He exchanged greetings with Mr. Osmond, to whom he had been introduced the day before, and who, after he came in, sat blandly apart and silent. The others came back, and the bare, trivial opera began again. The box was large, and there was room for Lord Warburton to remain if he would sit a little behind. He did so for half an hour, but he heard nothing, and from his gloomy corner saw nothing but the clear profile of Isabel, defined against the dim illumination of the house. At the next interval he departed.
"What's the character of that gentleman?" Osmond asked of Isabel.
"Irreproachable, don't you see it? He owns about half England. That's his character," Henrietta remarked.
"Oh, happy man," said Gilbert Osmond.
"Do you call that happiness, the ownership of wretched human beings?" cried Miss Stackpole.
"It seems to me you own a human being or two," Mr. Bantling suggested jocosely. "I wonder if Warburton orders his tenants about as you do me."
"Poor Lord Warburton's a very nice man," Isabel said.
"But why do you speak of your friend as poor?"
inquired Osmond.
"Women, when they are very good, sometimes pity men after they've hurt them. That's their great way of showing kindness," said Ralph, joining in the conversation with a cynicism so transparently ingenious as to be virtually innocent.
"Pray, have I hurt Lord Warburton?" Isabel asked, raising her eyebrows. "It serves him right if you have," said Henrietta, as the curtain rose. Isabel saw no more of Lord Warburton for the next 24 hours, but then she encountered him in the Capitol, where he stood before some sculptures. She had come in with her companions, among whom, on this occasion again, Gilbert Osmond had his place.
"I'm leaving Rome," Lord Warburton told her. "You'll probably think that's strange after I told you how much I wanted to stay."
"Oh, no. You could easily change your mind."
"That's what I've done."
"Bon voyage, then."
"You're in a great hurry to get rid of me," said his lordship quite dismally. "You obviously don't care what I do."
Isabel looked at him a moment. "Oh, you're not keeping your promise." He blushed.
"If I'm not, then it's because I can't, and that's why I'm going."
"Goodbye, then."
"Goodbye."
He lingered still, however.
"When shall I see you again?"
Isabel hesitated. "Someday, after you've married."
"That will never be. It will be after you are."
"That will do as well," she smiled. They shook hands, and he left her alone among the shining antique marbles. Shortly before the time fixed for Isabel's departure from Rome, she received a telegram from Mrs. Touchett. Leave Florence, June 4th for Bellagio, and take you if you have not other views, but can't wait if you dawdle in Rome. The dawdling in Rome was very pleasant, but Isabel let her aunt know she would immediately join her. She told Gilbert Osmond that she had done so, and he replied that he himself would stay a little longer. He would not return to Florence for 10 days more, and in that case it might be months before he should see her again. This exchange took place in the sitting room occupied by our friends at the hotel. It was late in the evening, and Osmond found the girl alone, reading.
"You'll say you'll come back, but who knows?" he said to her. "I think you may start on your voyage around the world."
"Well, I can take Italy in on the way," Isabel answered.
"On the way round the world? No, don't do that. Don't put us in a parenthesis. Give us a chapter to ourselves. I don't want to see you on your travels. I'd rather see you when they're over, when you're tired and satiated."
Isabel, with her eyes bent, fingered the pages of her book. She was thinking that the pleasantest incident of her life, so it pleased her to qualify these days in Rome, was coming to an end. That most of the interest of the time had been owing to Mr. Osmond was a reflection she was not just now at pains to make. She might come back to Italy and find him different, this strange man who pleased her just as he was, and it would be better not to come than run the risk of that. But if she was not to come, the greater the pity that the chapter was closed. She felt a pang of regret that kept her silent. Gilbert Osmond was silent, too.
"Go everywhere,"
he said at last in a low, kind voice.
"Do everything, get everything out of life. Be happy."
"Doing all the vain things one likes is often very tiresome."
"Exactly,"
said Osmond with his quiet quickness.
"As I intimated just now, you'll be tired some day."
He paused a moment and then went on,
"I don't know whether I had better not wait till then for something I want to say to you."
"Oh, I can't advise you without knowing what it is, but I'm horrid when I'm tired," Isabel added with due inconsequence.
"I'm speaking very seriously."
Gilbert Osmond leaned forward.
"What I wish to say to you is that I find I'm in love with you."
Isabel instantly rose. "Oh, keep that till I am tired."
"Tired of hearing it from others? No, you may heed it now, or never, as you please."
He got up and came near to her.
"I'm absolutely in love with you. I haven't the idea that it will matter much to you. I've too little to offer you. I've neither fortune nor fame nor extrinsic advantages of any kind. And if you were not going away, you'd know me better."
"I shall do that some other time," said Isabel, with a pale smile.
"I hope so. I'm very easy to know."
"No, no," she emphatically answered. "You're not easy to know. No one could be less so. But you're very wise."
"So are you, Miss Archer."
"I don't feel so just now. Still, I'm wise enough to think you had better go. Good night."
"God bless you,"
said Gilbert Osmond, taking the hand which she failed to surrender.
"If we meet again, you'll find me as you leave me. If we don't, I shall be so all the same. But there's one thing more. I haven't asked anything of you, not even a thought in the future. But there's a little service I should like to ask. Go and see Pansy before you leave Florence. She's alone at the villa. Tell her she must love her poor father very much."
"It will be a great pleasure for me to go." On this, Gilbert Osmond took a rapid, respectful leave. Isabel stood a moment looking about her. Her agitation was very still, very deep. What had happened was something that for a week past her imagination had been going forward to meet. But here, when it came, She stopped. Her imagination hung back, unable to move. Isabel returned to Florence the following day with Ralph Touchett. She had 3 days before her departure, and she determined to spend the last of these visiting Pansy Osmond. Madame Merle was still at Casa Touchett, but she too was on the point of leaving Florence to stay in the mountains. Isabel mentioned to her that Mr. Osmond had asked her to visit Pansy, but she didn't mention his declaration of love.
"Well, I don't know about your going alone to the house of a handsome bachelor," Madame Merle exclaimed.
"But he's away."
"No one knows he's away, but perhaps it doesn't signify. I suppose you just want to be kind to the child."
"I wish very much to be kind to her."
"Go and see her, then. No one will be the wiser."
As Isabel drove to Mr. Osmond's hilltop, she wondered what her friend had meant by this comment. Once in a while, this lady dropped a remark of ambiguous quality, struck a false note. But perhaps she had misunderstood. Pansy was strumming at the piano when Isabel was ushered into Mr. Osmond's drawing room. The little girl immediately came in and did the honors of her father's house with a wide-eyed earnestness of courtesy. Isabel wondered at her. She had never had so directly presented to her nose the white flower of cultivated sweetness. How well the child had been taught, thought our admiring young woman. How prettily she had been directed and fashioned, and yet how simple, how natural, how innocent she had been kept.
"Please tell me," Pansy said, "did Papa in Rome go to see Madame Catherine? Perhaps he had no time. He wished to speak about my education. It isn't finished yet, you know. Papa told me one day he thought he would finish it himself, for the last year at the convent, the masters that teach the tall girls are so very dear. Papa's not rich, but I would like to return. I miss Madame Catherine very much. Papa has always been principally for holidays, but you must not tell him that. You shall not see him again. I'm very sorry. And he'll be sorry, too, but it was very kind of you to come today."
When Isabel left, she kissed the child goodbye and held her close. "Be very good. Give pleasure to your father."
"I think that's what I live for," Pansy answered. "He has not much pleasure. He's rather a sad man."
Isabel listened to this assertion with an interest she felt obliged to conceal. She would have taken a passionate pleasure in talking of Gilbert Osmond to this innocent creature who was so near him, but she said no other word. Isabel stood at the window in the Palazzo Crescentini as though expecting a visitor. It was almost a year since she was there last. She felt herself a very different person from the frivolous young woman from Albany who had arrived at Gardencourt a couple of years before. If her thoughts just now had inclined themselves to retrospect instead of worrying about the present, they would have evoked some interesting pictures. Over the past year, she had spent the summer with her sister Lily in Switzerland, and she had kept in contact with Madame Merle. After her sister's departure for America, she wrote to that lady that she would leave Switzerland immediately and make her way to Rome. She accomplished this journey without other assistance than that of her servant. Ralph Touchett was spending the winter at Corfu, and Miss Stackpole had been recalled to America by the interviewer. Isabel wrote to her aunt to apologize for not presenting herself just yet in Florence, but Mrs. Touchett was secretly pleased, because she took it for a sign that Gilbert Osmond was less in question there than formerly. Isabel, on her side, had not been a fortnight in Rome before she proposed to Madame Merle that they should travel east. Madame Merle remarked that she had always been consumed with a desire to visit Constantinople and Egypt, and the two ladies accordingly embarked on this expedition. Isabel returned to Rome at the end of March. A few days after her arrival, Gilbert Osmond descended from Florence and remained 3 weeks, during which the fact of her lodging with his old friend Madame Merle made it virtually inevitable that he should see her every day. When the last of April came, Isabel went to Florence, to Palazzo Crescentini. She found her aunt alone. Ralph, however, was expected daily, and Isabel was prepared to give him a most affectionate welcome. It was not of him, nevertheless, that she was thinking while she stood at the window and the servant showed in the visitor. She turned round when they were alone. Caspar Goodwood stood there. He had the air of a man who had travelled hard, and he offered no greeting. "I can't tell you how I hoped you wouldn't come."
"I've no doubt of that."
Caspar Goodwood looked about him for a seat. "When did you arrive?" Isabel asked, seating herself.
"Late last night. I left New York 17 days ago. These Italian express trains go at the rate of an American funeral."
"That's in keeping. You must have felt as if you were coming to bury me." She forced a smile.
"I wish I could. I'd rather think of you dead than married to another man."
"That's very selfish of you," she returned. But to change the subject, she asked him if he had seen Henrietta Stackpole.
"Yes, she called at my office the day I got your letter."
"Did you tell her?"
"Oh, no," said Caspar Goodwood simply. "I didn't want to do that." "Does she know Mr. Osmond?"
"A little, and she doesn't like him. But of course I don't marry to please Henrietta." Caspar Goodwood ignored this, but asked her abruptly when her marriage would take place. "I don't know. I can only say it will be soon. I've told no one but yourself and an old friend of Mr. Osmond's."
"Is it a marriage your friends won't like?"
"I really haven't any idea. As I say, I don't marry for my friends."
"Who and what, then, is Mr. Gilbert Osmond?"
"Who and what? Nobody and nothing, but a very good and very honorable man," said Isabel.
"But what has he ever done?"
"That I should marry him? Nothing at all. Give me up, Mr. Goodwood. I'm marrying a perfect nonentity."
"You don't mean that. You think he's grand, but no one else thinks so."
Isabel's color deepened. "Why do you always come back to what others think? I can't discuss Mr. Osmond with you."
"No."
The young man looked gloomy.
"Well, I shan't trouble you for a long time."
He stood up.
"One of the reasons why I came was that I wanted to hear what you would say in explanation of your having changed your mind."
"In explanation? Do you think I'm bound to explain?"
"No, I suppose not. Well, at least I've seen you."
He turned away, and no handshake, no sign of parting, was exchanged between them. After he had gone out, Isabel burst into tears. An hour or so later, Isabel broke the news to her aunt. "Aunt Lydia, I've something to tell you." Mrs. Tutchett looked at her fiercely.
"You needn't tell me. I know what it is. You're going to marry that man."
"What man do you mean?" Isabel inquired with great dignity.
"Madame Merle's friend, Mr. Osmond."
"I don't know why you call him Madame Merle's friend."
"If he's not her friend, he ought to be, after what she has done for him," cried Mrs. Tutchett.
"If you mean that Madame Merle has had anything to do with my engagement, you're greatly mistaken," Isabel declared coldly.
"You mean that your attractions were sufficient without the gentleman's having had to be lashed up? You're quite right. They're immense, your attractions, and he would never have presumed to think of you if she hadn't taken the trouble to put him up to it."
"He has taken a great deal for himself," cried Isabel. Mrs. Tutchett nodded.
"I think perhaps he must have to have made you like him so much. Was it for this that you refuse Lord Warburton?"
"Please, don't go back to that. Why shouldn't I like Mr. Osmond?"
He has no money. He has no name. He has no importance. Do you marry him out of charity?
It was my duty to tell you, Aunt Lydia, but I don't think it's my duty to explain to you. Even if it were, I shouldn't be able.
Well, I'll say nothing more, but I don't know what Ralph will say. He cares very much for you.
I know he does, and I shall feel the value of it now, for he knows that whatever I do with reason.
Ralph Touchett arrived the following day, and Isabel was shocked by his appearance. She had forgotten how ill he looked. But though Isabel was sure that Mrs. Touchett had lost no time in imparting to him the great fact, he showed at first no open knowledge of it. After 3 days had elapsed without him speaking of the matter, our young woman wearied of waiting. Dislike it as he would, he might at least go through the form. But since Ralph's arrival at Palazzo Crescentini, he had privately gone through many forms. His mother had literally greeted him with the great news, which had been even more sensibly chilling than Mrs. Touchett's maternal kiss. Ralph was shocked and humiliated. The person in the world in whom he was most interested was lost. What could he do? What could he say? At this moment, Gilbert Osmond showed himself little at Palazzo Crescentini, but Isabel met him every day elsewhere, as she was now free to do. One morning, after meeting her lover, Isabel returned through the garden and saw Ralph sitting there in a chair. The extreme relaxation of his attitude suggested at first to Isabel that he was asleep. She stood for a moment looking at him. During this instant, he opened his eyes.
"I'm sorry I waked you. You looked so tired," she said, sitting down.
"I feel too tired, but I was not asleep. I was thinking of you."
"Are you tired of that?"
"Very much so. It leads to nothing."
"What do you wish to arrive at?"
"At the point of expressing to myself properly what I think of your engagement."
"Don't think too much of it," she lightly returned.
"But I had an idea you may have found me wanting in good manners. I've never congratulated you."
"Of course I've noticed that. Why were you silent?"
Ralph sat looking at her.
"I think I've hardly got over my surprise," he said at last. "I had amused myself with planning out a high destiny for you. You were the last person I expected to see caught."
"I don't know why you call it caught."
"Because you're going to be put into a cage."
"If I like my cage, it needn't trouble you," she answered. "But you're beating about the bush, Ralph. You wish to say you don't like Mr. Osmond, but you're afraid."
"I'm afraid of you, not of him. If you marry him..."
"If I marry him? Have you had any expectation of dissuading me?"
"Of course, that seems to you too fatuous."
"No. I know you've a great affection for me. I can't get rid of that."
"For heaven's sake, don't try. Keep that well in sight. It will convince you how intensely I want you to do well."
"But you talk of my higher destiny. Surely there's nothing higher for a girl than to marry a person she likes."
"It's your liking the person we speak of that I venture to criticize, my dear cousin. He's the incarnation of taste."
Ralph went on, thinking how he could best express Gilbert Osmond's sinister attributes.
"He judges and measures, approves and condemns altogether by that."
"It's a happy thing, then, that his taste should be exquisite."
"It's exquisite, indeed, since it has led him to select you. But have you ever seen this taste ruffled?"
"I hope it may never be my fortune to fail to gratify my husband's."
At these words, a sudden passion leapt to Ralph's lips.
"Oh, that's unworthy of you. You were meant for something better than to keep guard over the sensibilities of a sterile dilettante."
Isabel rose quickly, and he did the same. "You go too far," she breathed.
"I've said what I had on my mind, and I've said it because I love you."
Isabel turned pale. Was he too on that tiresome list? "Oh, then you're not disinterested."
"I love you, but I love you without hope," said Ralph,
forcing a smile and feeling that he had expressed too much. Isabel sighed. "I'm afraid your talk, then, is the wilderness of despair. I don't understand it. I'm not arguing with you. It's impossible I should. It's very good of you to try to warn me, if you're really alarmed. But I shall forget what you've said as soon as possible. Try and forget it yourself. You've done your duty, and no man can do more. I can't explain to you what I feel, and I wouldn't if I could." Ralph stared at her.
"I told you last year that if you were to get into trouble, I should feel terribly sold. That's how I feel today."
"Do you think I'm in trouble?"
"One's in trouble when one's in error."
"Very well," said Isabel. "I shall never complain of my trouble to you." And she turned and walked away.
Isabel, when she strolled in the Cascine with her lover, felt no impulse to tell him how disliked he was by her aunt and cousin. This dislike was not alarming to Isabel. She scarcely even regretted it, for it served mainly to throw into higher relief the fact, in every way so honorable, that she married to please herself. One did other things to please other people. One did this for a more personal satisfaction. And Isabel's satisfaction was confirmed by her lover's admirable good conduct. Gilbert Osmond was in love, and he had never deserved less than during these still, bright days, each of them numbered, the harsh criticism passed upon him by Ralph Touchett. Contentment on his part took no vulgar form. Excitement, in the most self-conscious of men, was a kind of ecstasy of self-control. He never forgot to be graceful and tender, to wear the appearance, which presented no difficulty, of stirred senses and deep intentions. He was immensely pleased with his young lady. Madame Merle had made him a present of incalculable value. He knew perfectly, though he had not been told, that their union enjoyed little favor with the girl's relations, and one morning he made an abrupt allusion to it.
"It's the difference in our fortune they don't like. They think I'm in love with your money."
"How do you know what they think?" Isabel asked.
"Well, you've not told me they're pleased. If they had been delighted, I should have had some sign of it. And the fact of my being poor, and you rich, is the most obvious explanation of their reserve. But I don't mind them. I only care for one thing— for you're not having the shadow of a doubt. We've got my poor child to amuse us. It's all soft and mellow. It has the Italian coloring."
They made a good many plans, but they left themselves also a great deal of latitude. It was a matter of course, however, that they should live for the present in Italy. It was in Italy that they had met. Italy had been a party to their first impressions of each other, and Italy should be a party to their happiness. One afternoon of the autumn of 1876, a young man of pleasing appearance rang at the door of an old Roman house. On its being opened, he inquired for Madame Merle, whereupon the servant ushered him into the drawing-room and requested his name.
"Mr. Edward Rosier," said the young man.
Mr. Rosier was an ornament of Mrs. Touchett's American circle in Paris.
but spent his summers in numerous resorts. In the summer of 1876, he passed a month in the Upper Engadine and encountered at St. Moritz a charming young girl. To this little person he began to pay particular attention. She struck him as exactly the household angel he had been looking for. He was nothing if not discreet, for he forbore for the present to declare his passion. But he decided to go in the autumn to Rome, where Miss Osmond was domiciled with her family. Mr. Rosier arrived in the Italian capital in November and attended Mrs. Osmond's soirees. It was while at the Palazzo Rocconera that he met Madame Merle, and thinking her well accepted within the family, he now came to her for advice.
"I care very much for Miss Osmond," he said, after exchanging greetings with Madame Merle. "I should like particularly to know what you think of my prospects. I'm afraid Mr. Osmond doesn't consider me a collector's piece, although I think Mrs. Osmond would favor me."
"Very likely, if her husband doesn't." Rosier raised his eyebrows.
"Does she take the opposite line from him?"
"In everything. They think quite differently," said Madame Merle. "But have you declared your sentiments to the child?"
"Never," cried Rosier. "Never till I've assured myself of those of the parents."
"Well, you've excellent principles. You observe the proprieties, but what have you to offer?"
"I've a comfortable little fortune, about 40,000 francs a year. With the talent I have for arranging, we can live beautifully on such an income."
"Beautifully, no. Sufficiently, yes. And Mr. Osmond, to the best of my belief, can give her nothing." Rosier scarcely demurred.
"I don't in the least desire that he should, but I may remark, all the same, that he lives like a rich man."
"The money is his wife's, and Mrs. Osmond will probably prefer to keep her money for her own children."
"Surely she has none."
"She may have, yet. She had a poor little boy who died 2 years ago, 6 months after his birth. Others, therefore, may come." Madame Merle paused. "But regarding your position, of course 40,000 francs a year and a nice character are a combination to be considered. However, I'm not sure if Mr. Osmond will think so. But leave it to me. I'll try to make the most of your advantages."
Edward Rosier presented himself the following Thursday at Mrs. Osmond's evening. He entered the warm, rich-looking reception rooms and looked around eagerly for the daughter of the house. Pansy was not in the first of the rooms, a large apartment with a concave ceiling and walls covered with old red damask. Osmond stood before the chimney, leaning back with his hands behind him. Half a dozen persons scattered near him were talking together. Rosier went up to shake hands with him.
"How do you do? My wife's somewhere about."
"Never fear, I shall find her," said Rosier cheerfully.
Osmond, however, took him in. He had never in his life felt so efficiently looked at.
"Madame Merle has probably told him, and he doesn't like it," he privately reasoned.
He took his course to the adjoining room and met Mrs. Osmond coming out of the doorway. She was dressed in black velvet, and she struck our young man as the picture of a gracious lady.
"You see, I'm very regular," he said. "But who should be if I'm not?"
"Yes, I've known you longer than anyone here. But can I introduce you to anyone?"
"Thank you, but the simple truth is I'm dying to have a little talk with Miss Osmond."
"Oh," said Isabel, turning away. "I can't help you there." But before Rosier had time to dwell on this comment, he saw his small sweetheart enter on the other side of the room. Pansy, now at 19, was a young lady who had grown very pretty, although she still had the innocent nature of a child. Rosier thought her perfect. She was everything he had always dreamed of. He was desperate to be alone with her. There was another room beyond the one in which they stood that had remained empty. It was upholstered in pale yellow, and through the open door it looked the very temple of authorized love. Rosier gazed a moment through this aperture. He had already been there with Osmond to inspect a huge clock of the first French Empire. Now, after supreme hesitation, he approached Pansy and asked her if he might go and look at the Yellow Room. "Certainly you may go," said Pansy. "And if you like, I'll show you."
"That's just what I hoped you'd say," murmured Rosier.
They went in together. Rosier really thought the room very ugly. "It's Papa's taste," explained Pansy. "He has so much."
He had a good deal, Rosier thought, but some of it was very bad.
"Doesn't Mrs. Osmond care how her rooms are done? Has she no taste?" he asked.
"Oh, yes, a great deal. But it's more for literature," said Pansy, "and for conversation. But Papa also cares for those things. I think he knows everything."
Rosier was silent a little.
"There's one thing I'm sure he knows," he broke out presently. "He knows that when I come here, it's really to see you."
Pansy stood looking at him, simply, intently, openly. "I thought it was for that."
"And it was not disagreeable to you?"
"I couldn't tell. I didn't know. You never told me," said Pansy.
"Do you like me then, Pansy?"
Rosier asked very gently, feeling very happy.
"Yes, I like you." Rosier was elated. She liked him. She had liked him all the while. Now anything might happen.
Madame Merle, meanwhile, had arrived at Palazzo Rocanera, and after embracing Mrs. Osmond, she sat down on a small sofa to commune with the master of the house. There was a brief exchange of commonplaces between these two, and then Madame Merle, whose eyes had been wandering, asked if little Mr. Rosier had come this evening.
"He came nearly an hour ago, but he has disappeared,"
Osmond said.
"Do you wish to see him?"
Madame Merle looked at him a moment.
"Yes, I should like to say to him that I've told you what he wants and that it interests you but feebly."
"Don't tell him that. Tell him I hate his proposal. He's a nuisance."
Madame Merle dropped her eyes. She had a faint smile.
"He's a gentleman. He has a charming temper. And, after all, an income of 40,000 francs.
"It's misery. Genteel misery," Osmond broke in. "It's not what I've dreamed of for Pansy."
"But Pansy has thought a great deal about him."
"I don't consider that matters at all."
Osmond gazed a while before him.
"This kind of thing doesn't find me unprepared. It's what I educated her for. It was all for this, that when such a case should come up, she should do what I prefer."
At this point, Pansy came out of the adjoining room, followed by Edward Rosier.
"He has spoken to her,"
Madame Merle went on to Osmond.
Her companion never turned his head.
"He ought to be horsewhipped."
Madame Merle got up and moved towards Edward Rosier. He came to meet her, and very quickly, as if to get it off his mind,
"I've spoken to her," he whispered.
"I knew it, Mr. Rosier. Behave properly for the rest of the evening and come and see me tomorrow."
She was severe, and in the manner in which she turned her back to him there was a degree of contempt. He had no intention of speaking to Osmond. It was neither the time nor the place. But he instinctively wandered toward Isabel.
"You said just now you wouldn't help me,"
he began to Mrs. Osmond.
"Perhaps you'll feel differently when you know... when you know..."
Isabel met his hesitation.
"When I know what?"
"Well, that we've come to an understanding."
"It won't do. You're not rich enough for Pansy."
"She doesn't care a straw for one's money."
"No, but her father does," she said sharply. "And never forget it."
Seeing his solemn face, she was silent a minute.
"It's not that I won't help you," she continued passionately. I simply can't.
Edward Rosier called to see Madame Merle the following day. She told him that Gilbert Osmond was not favorable to his suit and had requested the matter dropped for a few weeks. "He doesn't like you having spoken to Pansy, Mr. Rosier. For the next month you must go to the house as little as possible and leave the rest to me."
"As little as possible?"
"Go only on Thursday evenings with the rest of the world and don't fret about Pansy. I'll see that she understands everything." Edward Rosier fretted about Pansy a good deal, but he did as he was advised and waited another Thursday evening before returning to Palazzo Rocconera. An unexpected visitor also arrived that evening and made himself known to his host. Gilbert Osmond directed the gentleman over to his wife.
"Isabel, I bring you an old friend."
Isabel was startled. She hardly knew if she felt pleasure or pain. "I'm very happy to see Lord Warburton." Lord Warburton was heavier than of yore and looked older. He stood there very solidly and sensibly.
"I've but just arrived. But, you see, I've lost no time in coming to pay you my respects. I knew you were at home on Thursdays." "Well, I'll leave you and Mrs. Osmond together, Lord Warburton. You have reminiscences into which I don't enter." "I'm afraid you lose a great deal, sir,"
Lord Warburton called after Osmond as he moved away, in a tone which perhaps betrayed overmuch an appreciation of his generosity. Then the visitor turned on Isabel the deepest consciousness of his look, which gradually became more serious.
"I'm really very glad to see you."
"You're very kind." They sat down, and Isabel asked him about his sisters, with other inquiries of a somewhat perfunctory kind. He answered her questions as if they interested him, and in a few moments she saw, or believed she saw, that he would press with less of his whole weight than of yore.
"There's something I must tell you without more delay, Mrs. Osmond. I've brought Ralph Touchett with me."
"Brought him with you?"
"He's at the hotel, but he was too tired to come out."
"But why has he come to Rome? I heard from him that he had determined to give up wintering abroad and remain in England, indoors, in what he called an artificial climate."
"Poor fellow. He doesn't succeed with artificial. I went to see him 3 weeks ago at Gardencourt and found him thoroughly ill. He's been getting worse every year. Mrs. Touchett is in America, and he felt it would be the saving of him to spend the winter at Catania. I wanted him to go by sea to save fatigue, but he said he hated the sea and wished to stop at Rome. After that, I made up my mind to come with him. He has been very bad since we left England a fortnight ago. He's got a rather good man, but I'm afraid he's beyond human help. I sometimes think he is dying."
Isabel sprang up. "I'll go to him then now." Lord Warburton checked her.
"I don't mean I thought so tonight. On the contrary, today he seemed particularly well. The idea of our reaching Rome gave him strength. An hour ago he told me he was very tired but very happy. Go to him in the morning."
Isabel had many questions to ask about Ralph, but she abstained from asking them all. She would see for herself on the morrow. Edward Rosier had, meanwhile, seated himself near Pansy. She asked him who was the new gentleman conversing with her stepmother.
"He's an English lord. I don't know his name. But never mind him. I've something particular to say to you."
"Don't speak so loud," said Pansy. "Papa has been terribly severe."
"What has he done to you?"
"He asked me what you had done to me, and I told him everything. Then he forbade me to marry you.
You needn't mind that.
But I can't disobey Papa.
Oh, you disappoint me,
groaned poor Rosier. I'll speak to Mrs. Osmond.
Well, she won't help us much. I think she's afraid of your father.
Pansy shook her little head. She's not afraid of anyone. We must have patience.
Oh, that's an awful word.
Rosier was deeply disconcerted. Oblivious of the customs of good society, he dropped his head into his hands and sat staring at the carpet. Presently he became aware of a good deal of movement about him, and as he looked up, saw Pansy making a curtsy to the English lord whom Mrs. Osmond had introduced. Ralph Touchett had seen very little of Isabel since her marriage. No reference was ever again made between them to Ralph's opinion of Gilbert Osmond, and by surrounding this topic with a sacred silence, they managed to preserve a semblance of reciprocal frankness. But there was a difference, as Ralph often said to himself. As Osmond's wife, Isabel could never again be his friend. He consoled himself as he might by behaving beautifully, and was present at the ceremony by which Isabel was united to Mr. Osmond in Florence. The thing was done at the little American chapel on a hot June day, in the presence only of Mrs. Touchett and her son, of Pansy Osmond and the Countess Gemini. Madame Merle had been invited, but she wrote that she was unable to leave Rome. Ralph knew little of Isabel's life in the 2 years that followed. Once, while he was spending the winter in San Remo, Ralph visited her. She had lost her child. That was a sorrow, but it was a sorrow she scarcely spoke of. There was more to say about it than she could say to Ralph. She appeared to be leading the life of the world. Ralph heard her spoken of as having a charming position. People considered it a privilege to know her. The free, keen girl had become quite another person. What he saw was the fine lady who was supposed to represent something. What did Isabel represent, Ralph asked himself, and he could only answer by saying that she represented Gilbert Osmond. He recognized Osmond at every turn. He saw how he kept all things within limits, how he adjusted, regulated, animated their manner of life. Everything he did was affectation, affectation so subtly considered that one often mistook it for impulse. His tastes, his studies, his accomplishments, his collections were all for a purpose. For Gilbert Osmond, Ralph was not important. He was Isabel's cousin, and he was rather unpleasantly ill. Osmond made the proper inquiries, asked about his health, about Mrs. Touchett. He addressed him on the few occasions of their meeting not a word that was not necessary. For all this, Ralph had had, toward the end of his visit, a sharp inward vision of Osmond's making it difficult for his wife to continue to receive him. He was not jealous. No one could be jealous of Ralph. But he made Isabel pay for her old-time kindness, and as Ralph had no idea of her paying too much, he had taken himself off. In doing so, he had deprived Isabel of a very interesting occupation. She had been constantly wondering what fine principle was keeping him alive. But what kept Ralph Touchett alive was simply the fact that he had not yet seen enough of the person in the world in whom he was most interested. He wanted to see what she would make of her husband, or what her husband would make of her. This was only the first act of the drama, and he was determined to sit out the performance. His determination had held good. It had kept him going some 18 months more, till the time of his return to Rome with Lord Warburton. Isabel called to see Ralph the day after Lord Warburton had notified her of his arrival in Rome. She spent an hour with him. It was the first of several visits. A fortnight elapsed, at the end of which Ralph announced to Lord Warburton that he wouldn't be going to Sicily.
Do you mean your return to England?
Oh, dear, no. I'll stay in Rome.
Rome won't do for you. Rome's not warm enough. I'll make it do. See how well I've done?
Lord Warburton looked at him a while, trying to see it.
I say,
he suddenly broke out,
did you really mean to go to Sicily when we started?
Oh, you ask too many questions. Let me put one. Did you come with me quite disinterestedly?
I don't know what you mean by that. I wanted to come abroad.
I suspect we've each been playing our little game.
Well, what does Mrs. Osmond think?
Ralph's companion asked eventually.
I've not told her. She'll probably say that Rome's too cold and even offer to go with me to Catania. In your place, I should like that. Her husband won't like it, and I don't want to make any more trouble between them.
Is there so much already?
There's complete preparation for it. Osmond isn't fond of me.
Then won't he make a row if you stop here?
That's what I want to see.
You're sacrificing your health to your curiosity, then?
I'm not much interested in my health, and I'm deeply interested in Mrs. Osmond.
So am I. But I don't mean to make love to her again,
Lord Warburton added quickly.
I'm delighted to hear it. But permit me to ask,
Ralph went on,
whether it's to bring out this fact that you're so very civil to the little girl.
Lord Warburton gave a slight start.
Well, I think her a delightful little person. Of course, there's the difference in our ages.
My dear Warburton,
said Ralph,
are you really serious?
Perfectly serious, as far as I've got.
I'm very glad. And heaven help us,
cried Ralph.
How cheered up old Osmond will be.
His companion frowned.
He's not so fond of me as that.
As that? My dear Warburton, the drawback of your position is that people needn't be fond of you at all to wish to be connected with you.
But Lord Warburton scarcely seemed to be listening.
Do you judge she'll be pleased?
The girl? Delighted, surely.
No, no, I mean Mrs. Osmond. She's very fond of Pansy.
Very true. Very true.
And Ralph slowly got up.
I hope, you know, that you're very, very sure.
The deuce!
He broke off.
I don't know how to say it.
Yes, you do. You know how to say everything.
Well, it's awkward. I hope you're sure that among Miss Osmond's merits, her being so near her stepmother isn't a leading one.
Good heavens, Touchett!
Cried Lord Warburton angrily.
What do you take me for?
Isabel did not see too much of Madame Merle during the first 2 years of her marriage. This lady had made numerous visits to distant friends and gave countenance to the idea that for the future she should be a less inveterate Roman than in the past. It was not until the winter, during which we have renewed acquaintance with our heroine, that the personage in question made again a continuous stay in Rome. But by this time, Isabel's needs and inclinations had considerably changed. It was not at present to Madame Merle that she would have applied for instruction. She had lost the desire to know this lady's clever trick. If she had troubles, she must keep them to herself. One day, about a month after Ralph Touchett's arrival in Rome, Isabel came back from a walk with Pansy. Pansy was very dear to her. The two were constantly together. On this particular day, Pansy had picked some wild flowers, and on returning to Palazzo Rocconera, she went straight to her room to put them into water.
Isabel passed into the drawing room, the one she herself usually occupied. But just beyond the threshold, she stopped short. Madame Merle was there in her bonnet, and Gilbert Osmond was talking to her. For a minute they were unaware she had come in. Madame Merle was standing a little way from the fire. Osmond was in a deep chair, leaning back and looking at her. What struck Isabel first was that he was sitting while Madame Merle stood. Then she perceived that they were musing face to face, with the freedom of old friends who sometimes exchange ideas without uttering them. There was nothing to shock in this. They were old friends. But the thing made an image, lasting only a moment, like a sudden flicker of light. Madame Merle had seen her and had welcomed her without moving. Her husband, on the other hand, had instantly jumped up and, after murmuring something, left the room.
"I've come to see you," said Madame Merle, "to get rid of a trouble of my own, to make it over to you. I've been talking to your husband about it."
"I'm surprised at that. He doesn't like troubles."
"Especially other people's, I know very well. But it's about poor Mr. Rosier. He comes to see me every day to talk about Pansy."
"Yes, he wants to marry her. I know all about it." Madame Merle hesitated.
"I gathered from your husband that perhaps you didn't."
"How should he know what I know? However, I can do nothing.
I have told him to be patient, but now he has taken it into his head to be jealous."
"Jealous?"
"Jealous of Lord Warburton. He thinks there's nothing impossible in Lord Warburton's falling in love with Pansy."
Isabel was silent a little. "It's true. There's nothing impossible."
"So I've had to admit to Mr. Rosier, so too your husband thinks."
"That I don't know. But I see no reason why I shouldn't tell you that Lord Warburton likes my stepdaughter very much."
"And you've never told Osmond?"
This observation was immediate, precipitate. It almost burst from Madame Merle's lips. Isabel's eyes rested on her. "I suppose he'll know in time. Lord Warburton has a tongue."
"That would be a great marriage. Much better than marrying poor Mr. Rosier," sighed Madame Merle.
"Much better, I think. But you had better wait till he asks her."
"If what you say is true, he'll ask her. Especially," Madame Merle said in a moment, "if you make him."
"If I make him?"
"You've great influence with him."
Isabel frowned. "Where did you learn that?"
"Mrs. Touchett told me. Not you, never," said Madame Merle, smiling. "She told me you had declined his offer of marriage. Of course, I think you've done better in doing as you did. But if you wouldn't marry Lord Warburton yourself, make him the reparation of helping him to marry someone else."
Isabel was silent for a while. But in a moment she said reasonably and gently enough, "I should be very glad indeed if, as regards Pansy, it could be arranged." Upon which her companion embraced her, more tenderly than might have been expected, and triumphantly withdrew. Osmond touched on this matter that evening for the first time, coming very late into the drawing-room where Isabel was sitting alone. They had spent the evening at home, and Pansy had gone to bed. He himself had been sitting since dinner in his study. At 10 o'clock, Lord Warburton had come in. He was going somewhere else and had sat for half an hour. Isabel, after asking him for news of Ralph, said very little to him, on purpose. She wished him to talk with her stepdaughter. It would please her husband greatly to see Pansy married to an English nobleman. It seemed to Isabel that if she could make it her duty to bring about such an event, she should play the part of a good wife. And she wanted to believe sincerely that she had been that. Enthusiasm had not come at first to Isabel, but it came today, and it made her feel almost happy. She was on the point of going out of the room and leaving Pansy and Lord Warburton alone, but something held her back. There was a vague doubt that interposed, a sense that she was not quite sure. So she remained in the drawing room, and after a while Lord Warburton went off to his party. Pansy said nothing whatever about him after he had gone, and went to bed. Isabel remained alone, looking at the fire, until her husband came in. He sat down in silence.
"Has Lord Warburton been here?"
he presently asked. "Yes, he stayed half an hour and sat on the sofa with Pansy."
"It seems to me he's attentive. Isn't that what you call it?"
"If you wish," said Isabel. Osmond turned to her.
"Are you trying to quarrel with me?"
"No. I'm trying to live at peace."
"Nothing's more easy. You know I don't quarrel myself."
"What do you call it when you try to make me angry?"
"I don't try."
Isabel smiled. "It doesn't matter. I've determined never to be angry again."
"Good. That's partly why I've not spoken to you about this business of my daughter's,"
Osmond said.
"I was afraid I should encounter opposition. I've sent your old friend Rosier about his business."
"Mr. Rosier is an old friend. But as regards Pansy, I've given him no encouragement."
"That's fortunate," Osmond observed. "My daughter has only to sit perfectly quiet to make a great marriage and become Lady Warburton."
"But perhaps she won't sit perfectly quiet if she loses Mr. Rosier," said Isabel frankly. Osmond sat gazing at the fire.
"She wishes above all to please me. But meantime, I should like our distinguished visitor to speak."
"He has spoken to me. He has told me he is absolutely charmed by Pansy." Osmond turned his head quickly.
"Why didn't you tell me that?"
he asked sharply.
"You must have a great deal of influence with him."
He got up and stood before the fire.
"Well, Pansy's future lies in your hands. With a little goodwill, you may do as I desire. Think it over," he said, and strolled out of the room.
Isabel leaned back in her chair and closed her eyes. The suggestion from another that she had a definite influence on Lord Warburton, this had given her the start that accompanies unexpected recognition. Was it true that there was something still between them that might be a handle to make him declare himself to Pansy? Was he in love with Gilbert Osmond's wife? Was she to cultivate the advantage she possessed in order to make him commit himself to Pansy, knowing he would do so for her sake and not for the small creature's own? Was this the service her husband had asked of her? Isabel's soul was haunted with terrors which crowded to the foreground of thought. The strange impression she had received that afternoon of her husband's being in more direct communication with Madame Merle than she suspected kept coming back to her. And now she wondered it had never come before. Isabel had a deep distrust of her husband. She flattered herself that she had kept her failing faith to herself, however, that no one suspected it but Osmond. Oh, he knew it. And there were times when she thought he enjoyed it. It had come gradually. It was not till the first year of their life together, so admirably intimate at first, had closed, that she had taken the alarm. Then the shadows had begun to gather. It was as if Osmond deliberately, almost malignantly, had put the lights out, one by one. He was not violent. He was not cruel. She simply believed he hated her. He had discovered that she was so different, that she was not what he had believed she would prove to be. She had too many ideas. He had thought at first he could change her, and she had done her best to be what he would like. But she was, after all, herself. And now there was no use pretending, wearing a mask, for he knew her and had made up his mind. She was not afraid of him. She had no apprehension he would hurt her, for the ill will he bore her was not of that sort. Until that morning, he had scarcely spoken to her for a week. She knew there was a special reason. He was displeased at Ralph Touchett staying on in Rome. He had told her a week before that it was indecent she should visit him at his hotel. It was Isabel's honest belief that she was not defiant. But she certainly couldn't pretend to be indifferent to Ralph. She believed he was dying, and that she should never see him again, and this gave her a tenderness for him she had never known before. Ralph made her feel the good of the world. He made her feel what might have been. And thus it seemed to her an act of devotion to conceal her misery from him. It lived before her again, that morning in the garden at Florence when he had warned her against Osmond. She had only to close her eyes to see the place, to hear his voice. She had told him then that from her at least he should never know if he was right. And this was what she was taking care of now. It gave her plenty to do. There was passion, exaltation, religion in it. Isabel sat and watched the fire go out. Her mind, assailed by visions, was in a state of extraordinary activity. But the main vision that she kept returning to was that of her husband and Madame Merle, unconsciously and familiarly associated.